Tuesday, July 2nd. I'm Phil Picardi with Minnesota's News on Your Schedule. Coming up on the NPR News Update, we'll hear about the plans to build around the new Viking Stadium. Also, Minnesota farmers are making an expensive leap into automation. Shipwreck hunters find the long-lost Henry B. Smith. And we will recount the heroic actions of a small group of Minnesota soldiers on this day, 150 years ago. In just a few months, construction begins on a new Viking Stadium in downtown Minneapolis. And now the Minnesota Sports Facilities Authority has approved negotiations with Ryan Companies for new parking ramps and skyway bridges. And as Matt Sepik reports, the project includes two office towers, apartments, and a public park.
Other than on Vikings game days, the area around the Metrodome has long been a pretty sleepy place. But the Vikings and the Minnesota Sports Facilities Authority hope to change that, not just with the new football stadium, but also with a major redevelopment of the land near it. Last night, the authority authorized negotiations with Ryan Companies to revamp five square blocks immediately west of the stadium. Though the contract has not been signed yet, it calls for two new parking ramps, something the Metrodome never had, plus more than 1 million square feet of office space in two 20-story towers. Apartments are part of the mix, too, along with a new city park and retail stores. Rick Collins is vice president of development at Ryan Companies. He says the project is an opportunity to put thousands of stadium parking spaces to use when there are no football games.
It's a very transit-oriented development site that provides great opportunities for employees, and it's wonderful to be able to work with the MSFA and the Vikings to use parking that would otherwise be used for a limited number of events and make it available on a weekday basis to a lot of employees who will need it.
But key to this plan is finding a major employer for the proposed office towers. Collins says his company is in talks with Wells Fargo, but the bank has not yet agreed to be the anchor tenant. A spokesperson for Wells Fargo said after the vote that the bank is encouraged by the progress of the plan and they're continuing to discuss the opportunity with Ryan. Tax breaks and other public incentives are often used to lure big employers. Collins says that's not the case with Wells Fargo. Public money is covering about half the cost of the stadium itself, but Ryan plans to finance what it calls the Downtown East Project with help from the city of Minneapolis. The plan calls for the city to use $65 million in bonds to finance one of the parking ramps and the park. However, revenue from the ramps will be used to pay off the bonds, and Ryan has said it'll assume the risk of any shortfalls for the first decade of operations. Minnesota Sports Facilities Authority Chair Michelle Kelm-Helgen says the plan does right by taxpayers.
This really is a good deal for the stadium authority because we recover all those operating costs with the guarantee that Ryan is putting in. Really, the city is using their bonding capacity to put together the financing for this, but it really is the ramps that are being used to pay off the bonds.
Ryan beat out two other bidders for the project. Kelm-Helgen says only Ryan was able to meet the goals outlined in the request for proposals. City Councilmember Cam Gordon is a longtime critic of using public money to fund the Viking Stadium. However, he says if it's done right, the development next door will be good for downtown. Still, Gordon says he wants to make sure the project is useful to city residents, especially the new park.
I'm concerned about the risk and all the public expense, and I really want to make sure that we're not just taking this all on so that we can give a great kind of a game day experience on this big green space next to the stadium that then sits idle, except that people can kind of look at it and go on it at their lunch breaks from the office towers.
Gordon, whose ward borders downtown, says he wants to see a full-service city park with a community center and other amenities. Ryan hopes to complete purchase of the five blocks owned by the Star Tribune by the end of the year. Once the city council signs off on the proposal, planners of the Downtown East Project hope to break ground in April and have tenants in the office towers in 2016, in time for the first kickoff at the new Viking Stadium.
Matt Sepik there in Minneapolis. Four teams are receiving instructions today for the competition to redesign the Nicollet Mall in downtown Minneapolis. Here's our Elizabeth Dunbar.
The four teams are comprised of 10 different architecture and design firms. Only two of the companies are based in Minneapolis. The others are from places like Copenhagen, Montreal, and Berkeley, California. The teams will work over the summer to formulate their ideas for the Nicollet Mall redesign. The city will name a winner in September and expects to hire that team to come up with the final design. Nicollet Mall had its last major reconstruction in the late 1980s. Since then, buses have beat up the street and granite sidewalks need replacing. City officials want to be able to run streetcars along the mall, and they want the corridor to be pedestrian-friendly year-round. The city says the right design could win Nicollet Mall international acclaim, as well as attract businesses and investment to downtown Minneapolis. Elizabeth Dunbar, Minnesota Public Radio News.
In a report to regulators, Xcel Energy says that until there's a greater cost for emitting carbon, the cheapest way to create energy at the Sherco power plant is by continuing to burn coal. Conrad Wilson reports.
In its report to the State Public Utilities Commission, Xcel presented the economics of energy at the Sherco plant. Jim Alders is the regulatory strategy consultant for Xcel. He says the study looked at various alternatives, such as building natural gas plants and conservation.
We concluded that they can be very economical resources for our customers well into the future, depending on what public policy develops around questions like carbon and climate change.
Coal plants like Sherco are a big source of greenhouse gases. The report comes a week after President Obama announced new rules for power plants to reduce emissions that contribute to climate change. Conrad Wilson, Minnesota Public Radio News, Collegeville.
Groups on both sides of the abortion issue are hailing a report released yesterday showing a continued decline in abortions performed in Minnesota. Our Brant Williams has more.
The report from the Minnesota Department of Health shows that the number of abortions performed in Minnesota dropped from just over 11,000 in 2011 to about 10,700 in 2012, a decrease of 3%. Data show the number of abortions has dropped consistently over a six-year period. Officials with Minnesota Citizens Concerned for Life, a group opposed to legal abortion, say the report is good news because it indicates that laws passed about 6 years ago are having an impact. Spokesman Bill Paler says the so-called Women's Right to Know law and the Positive Alternatives Act have helped turn women away from abortion. Sarah Stace, the president and CEO of Planned Parenthood of Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota, also hails the drop in abortions. However, in a statement, Stace credits access to birth control for the decline. Brant Williams, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
This week, the number of new laws, including some tax increases, take effect in Minnesota. A tax hike on cigarettes is helping to pay for the new Vikings stadium. The cost of each pack is going up $1.60. We took our microphones out to the streets of downtown St. Paul to sample the opinions of smokers.
Luke Shifsky from Hugo, Minnesota. I don't like it. I don't think it's their prerogative to curb my behavior. I know it's bad for me, and I'm still doing it anyway, and I'm still going to.
Lorna Kasten, South St. Paul. I have no opinion whatsoever other than that I hate football and I resent having to pay for the stadium. And I'd like to know how they're going to pay for the stadium when everyone quits smoking.
My name's Aaron Hansen. I'm from St. Paul. They need to tax me to build the stadium. I think it's worth it. I'm going to smoke. I'm going to pay what they cost. So I'm not too concerned about it. I think we'd need a new stadium, and anything I can do to help, why not?
George Andrew Schmidt. Actually, I grew up until I was 12 over in Richfield. When I started smoking, cigarettes were 65 cents a pack out of the machine. You know, they're trying to raise the prices to get young people to quit. And I think it's just that they want to get all they can.
Tyler Smith, Cottage Grove. You know, in other places they charge quite a bit more, but I know in southern states it's less, so just going to have to keep on budgeting. I get mine from a tobacco store and I roll my own, so saves me quite a bit of money. I get 2.5 cartons for about $30.
Smokers in downtown St. Paul reacting to the cigarette tax increase that went into effect this week. It's the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. Tonight, at a handful of dairy farms in Minnesota, robots will tackle the evening milking chores. The number of automated milking systems has grown steadily since the first farmer in southwestern Minnesota installed a milking robot 7 years ago. The robots allow for complete automation of the milking process and essentially let the cows milk themselves. The machines can give dairy farmers some freedom, but as Elizabeth Baer reports, they come at a real cost.
In a small room on one side of Gary Kiefer's dairy barn, a cow walks into a square metallic box.
They're just free-flowing, coming in whenever.
An electronic tag around the cow's neck identifies her to the robot. It tells the machine where she is in her milking cycle and dispenses an exact amount of feed in a small trough at the end of the box. The pellets are a treat to get the cow in place. Once there, a robotic arm swings underneath her udder and two small spinning brushes clean the cow.
It'll wash her off. We have it washed two times. And then the laser will go on and identify the teats and attach the milk.
While the robot pumps the cow for milk, it also gathers vital information like the cow's height and weight and the butter fat and protein levels in the milk. The whole process takes about 10 minutes. When the machine is done, the computer unlocks the gate and the cow walks back into the barn. The next cow steps in and repeats the process. In all, the machines milk about 300 cows on Kiefer's farm just outside Utica in southeastern Minnesota. Kiefer says training the cows to walk into the machines was no easy task.
You had to push them in the first day or so and get them used to coming into the robot. After 3 days, they started coming in better. And it got a lot easier. After 3 months, it got super easier, but it took time.
Now, the barn is surprisingly calm. Kiefer says no more chasing cows at milking time. And he says his quality of life has also improved. Instead of milking cows 3 times a day, every single day, his hours are flexible. If a robot has a problem, the machines call him on his cell phone. And he's almost entirely eliminated his labor costs.
You don't have to be here with the cows. We can spread out our days much easier if we have hay to make. We don't have to spend time right then with the cows. We can do it later. And it just seems that the technology of milking here it gives us variety.
But that technology comes with a steep price tag. Kiefer spent $800,000 on 5 robotic milkers a few years ago. He estimates it'll take about 6 years to see a profit. Researchers at the University of Minnesota are in the process of analyzing a year's worth of data gathered from 52 Minnesota and Wisconsin dairy farms that now use robotic milking technology. It's a tiny percentage of the 16,000 dairy farms in the two states. But Professor Marcia Endres says the technology has had a huge impact, especially on mid-sized farms.
Precision dairy, I think, has kept some of the farms, especially the 120 to 140 cow size, in business.
Endres says the technology has changed quickly in the last few years. Robot manufacturers now offer iPhone and iPad apps, which let farmers track the robots from a distance.
The economics are getting better, but it's still a little bit of, you need to have very good equity to get started in this system, because they're very high tech and it's a cost benefit thing. They give you a lot of information, but they're not going to be extremely cheap, obviously.
Endres acknowledges the high cost of the milking robots has kept farmers like Pine Island producer Dwayne Alberts from making the switch. Alberts is at a dairy expo in Rochester on a recent afternoon. He's looking at an automated calf feeding system for his farm, where he milks 600 cows. But like many dairy farmers in southeastern Minnesota, Alberts lost all of his alfalfa crop this year, and money is tight.
A lot of this technology is nice to look at, but I don't know about this year. This year it might be just a little high priced, but next year hopefully things will be a little better, and I sure would like that manure scraper.
Alberts wants to replace his milking parlor with automatic milking machines, but he might have to start with the scraper, which at $15,000 is a fraction of the cost of a robotic milker. Elizabeth Baer, Minnesota Public Radio News, Utica.
Minnesota crops continue to lag well behind normal. They've been hurt by too much rain and not enough heat. So says Mark Style.
The corn crop showed nice improvement last week, increasing in height an average of 7 inches, but it's still far shorter than it should be at the start of July, averaging 17 inches tall compared to a normal height of 32 inches. Soybeans are also behind at about half their normal height. The state's best crop so far may be sugar beets. 68% are rated in good or excellent condition. About 58% of the corn is in that category. Heavy rains continue to plague state farmers. Since April 1st, rainfall in Rochester is more than 14 inches above normal. But Crookston, Becker, Alexandria, and Redwood Falls are all on the dry side, having received less precipitation than expected since the start of the growing season. Mark Style, Minnesota Public Radio News, Worthington.
Cloquet's Jerry Eliason is part of a team that's found the Henry B. Smith. The big freighter lost on Lake Superior 100 years ago has been positively ID'd. Tom Cran talked to Eliason last night on All Things Considered.
So tell me what your reaction was when you finally confirmed via the video camera that it was Henry B. Smith.
Well, for me, there was a fair amount of relief simply because back in 2004, I was part of a group that misidentified a wreck. We found the wreck of the Thomas Ryan, but we initially thought it was the Robert Wallace. So my friends haven't let me forget about that for a long time, so it was just relief that we finally had the 100% proof positive.
And that's because you saw the name right on the hull of the ship, right?
Both on the bow and on the stern. The better photographs we got and video we got were on the stern, but we also saw it on the bow.
So how aware were you previously of that ship and that it had not been confirmed or positively identified?
Well, I had read about that ship going back 40 years ago, but I never really intended to look for it. Just knew that it was a big freighter that sailed out of Marquette on November 9th, 1913, mm-hmm. and was never seen again. Knowing how far it is off of Marquette, it's clear that it went down not until November 10th, which incidentally is the same day that the Edmund Fitzgerald went down.
Exactly, in 75, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So tell me about exactly where you found this and what sort of sleuthing did it take from you to know where it was?
Through researching government information on another wreck in Newfoundland that we've been looking for, I came across some data that presented possibilities in looking for hot spots, so to speak, where a wreck might be. And thanks to my wife's great computer skills, we were able to process this data and come up with spots that were worth checking out.
And when you say data, what kind of stuff are you looking at, information?
Well, that's it. At this time, we're treating that as a trade secret.
Okay.
But the Freedom of Information Act was very helpful.
Now, what were conditions like that allowed you to actually get a video here? Because you had to hook up a camera that's that can go down, 500 feet or so, right? And it has to be pretty resistant to pressure and all that?
Yeah, well, I've been refining that process over the years. I had a dive accident, actually, in 1989, so I haven't been diving since then. But in order to keep exploring the underwater world, I kept working on different camera systems, building them in the living room. My wife would have much preferred I built them in the basement, I think. But we got, so we can get a pretty good view of the wrecks in high definition. The camera system I use takes photographs simultaneously with collecting high-def video.
All right, tell me about hunting shipwrecks. And for you, what is this fascination?
Well, to me, it's solving the mystery of what happened and where it happened. Just being able to connect with history, that's part of it. And then, I've been blessed with having worked with a group of other people who have the same interest and passion for it as I do. Craig Smith and I have been poking around the lake together for 33 years. And I don't know why we had a 13-year dry spell where we never found a wreck. We'd go out 12, 15 days a year, and that went on for 13 years, and we still kept doing it. So,
for a shipwreck hunter like yourself, how big a discovery is this?
As far as finding more major shipwrecks in Lake Superior, I didn't think it was going to happen.
So it's a fairly big deal.
Yeah, it's the biggest deal that's happened in my life since my son was born, I think. So.
Yeah. Well, congratulations. Jerry Eliason, part of the team of shipwreck enthusiasts who found the Henry B. Smith and positively identified it. That freighter went down on Lake Superior 100 years ago. Thanks, Jerry, for speaking with us.
Thank you very much. Yes, goodbye.
That's Jerry Eliason and Tom Cran on ATC. Now, for the rest of the podcast, what may be Minnesota's proudest moment? Today, 150 years ago, on the second day of the three-day Battle of Gettysburg, the 1st Minnesota Regiment charged into the history books. What did they do? Kathy Werzer talked with Richard Moe. He's the author of The Last Full Measure, The Life and Death of the First Minnesota Volunteers.
Gettysburg is seen as one of the pivotal battles of the Civil War. How desperate was the situation when the Minnesotans were ordered to charge the Confederates?
It was clearly very desperate. The regiment was positioned on Cemetery Ridge, in their part of the Second Corps. General Winfield Scott Hancock was the commanding general. To their left was the Third Corps, commanded by General Dan Sickles, who was not a professional soldier. He didn't like his ground, so he disobeyed orders and moved his corps a half mile ahead. What this did was to open a huge gap in the Union lines. Needless to say, the Confederates saw it, and they sent these Alabama regiments charging through there. General Hancock saw what this would mean. It would mean that the Confederates could roll up the Union lines and get behind and totally disrupt the operation and probably prevail on that day in the battle. And the Battle of Gettysburg could have been lost by the Union. But General Hancock came up, asked Colonel Colville from Red Wing,
right,
the commanding officer, which regiment is this? And Colonel Colville said, the 1st Minnesota, sir. Charge those lines, he said. And they did. They looked down that hill, Kathy, and they looked at what was coming. 1,600 Alabamans firing, cannon fire coming at them. And they knew what was going to happen to them.
Well, this was a suicide mission.
You could argue that, but they didn't see it that way. They just did it. And they stunned the Alabamans, totally stunned them, because they hadn't expected this. They thought they would remain stationary. But as Hancock saw, if they had remained stationary, they would have been overrun. So they totally shocked the Confederates and prevailed. And they bought, he was buying time, and they bought enough time for reinforcements to come up. But as you point out, they suffered horrendous casualties. We'll never know exactly what the right percentage was, but at the time it was thought they suffered 82% casualties, which is the highest casualty rate of any Union unit during the Civil War.
What were the accounts like of the battle? I can't imagine the thick smoke, probably, because of cannon fire and
yes,
musket fire, and the roar and the sounds must have been horrible.
Yeah, it had to be horrible. And these shells were exploding all over them. There are accounts of men looking to their right and looking to their left, men falling, knowing they could be and probably would be next. In many cases, that was true. And even when they got to the bottom, there was very little protection, so they got picked off by the snipers one by one.
So they bought some time. And the next day, the Confederates, as I remember reading, charged Cemetery Ridge. That was the legendary Pickett's Charge.
Pickett's Charge the next day. What was left of the 1st Minnesota, plus some other units that came back, had to fight all over again. And it's just extraordinary what they did. And this involved a lot of hand-to-hand combat, which was brutal, just brutal. But they fought them off again. And then, they were just totally exhausted. There's one very poignant incident that I captured, because I tell the story really through two brothers, Isaac and Henry Taylor. And Henry Taylor, they both made the charge, but at the end of the second day after the charge, he couldn't find his brother. Until the next morning, somebody said they thought they saw him. And sure enough, he went over and identified his brother, who was dead. And he writes to his sister very poignantly about enlisting two comrades to help bury Isaac. They were very close. They each kept diaries, and they really told the story of this regiment.
You talk about the Taylor boys, but beyond those two, who were these men? These boys, really?
A lot of them were boys. There's a 15-year-old boy from Winona named Charlie Goddard. He passed himself off as 18 and got away with it. But he was way over his head. But he developed into a very competent soldier. He ultimately got wounded and died shortly after the war. But they were very young. They're mostly farmers. They came from small river towns in Minnesota, because that's where the population was in Minnesota. Stillwater, Owatonna, Hastings, so Faribault, so forth. And people ask, why did they fight? Why did they fight so bravely? Well, there's no explanation, and they didn't talk about it, but I concluded what it all came down to was duty. They really believed in the cause that they were fighting for. They were all newcomers to Minnesota. And, Minnesota was then the newest state 3 years old. And these men wanted to prove themselves. They wanted to prove that they were part of the United States of America. And they were fighting for each other. They had gone through hell together. And they knew that the man on their right and the man on the left were depending on them.
Because I think most people don't know that the 1st Minnesota fought bravely in other battles prior to Gettysburg.
Absolutely. It wasn't just Gettysburg. They got shot up at the first Battle of Bull Run. They went through the whole Peninsula Campaign, which was, you know, they kept winning victories and retreating because of General McClellan, who always thought he was outnumbered. They fought at Antietam. It got very bloodied at Antietam. They were spared at Fredericksburg and Chancellorsville, but then they went to Gettysburg, and they were right in the thick of it.
You know, I recall an interview we had here on Minnesota Public Radio fairly recently. It was a historian from Virginia who said, yeah, the 1st Minnesota fought bravely. No doubt about it. That was a heck of a charge. But what they did, he felt, wasn't exactly the pivotal moment that other historians think it was. What do you say to that?
It's hard to say in a battle as large and complex as Gettysburg that there was one pivotal moment. But this was unquestionably a pivotal moment. You cannot underestimate the importance of what the 1st Minnesota did. It's one of the proudest moments in our state's history.
How were the soldiers, when they got back, treated by the public?
They were venerated by the public. Even before they left the Eastern Theater, there was a huge banquet for them in Washington. The vice president showed up. Most of the cabinet showed up. They were feted all over the place. And when they came back finally, when their three-year enlistments were up, they took the railroad back to La Crosse. Railroad didn't come to Minnesota yet. So they returned on horse-driven sleighs covered with buffalo robes coming up the frozen Mississippi. And the people of St. Paul came out and greeted them and held a huge banquet for them.
Richard Moe, always a pleasure having you here.
Thank you, Kathy. Great to be here.
Author Richard Moe and Kathy Werzer. 150 years ago today, the 1st Minnesota gave it all to halt a Confederate advance at Gettysburg. The news keeps on advancing, and I'll have the NPR News Update right here again tomorrow. I'm Phil Picardi. Thanks for listening.